You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. This show was born out of a desire to help guide parents and adolescent services industry professionals alike to professional resources as they face critical moments with their children and or clients. Today, we have with us Pat Montgomery. Pat is the author of Now You Know What I Know, which is Parenting Wisdom of a Grandmother, and her new companion book, Now, What Do You Do? A Wisdom Guide Written by You for Your Children. Pat is also the host of Parents Rule, which is a radio show on Radio Sandy Springs every Thursday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. She is also an entrepreneur, where she owns a consulting company in the railroad industry, and which she runs with her husband. She is a speaker, a trainer, an RN, active in city government, wife, mother of three, stepmother of two, and grandmother of 11. Wow. I'm going to bring her up right now. Pat? Pat, welcome to the show.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I am doing great. And after I just went through that introduction, what do you do in your spare time?
What do I... Spare time?
Yeah. What is that word? That's
I
strange
actually started
word.
A vegetable garden for the first time in years this year.
Wow. I got to tell
so
you.
So that's keeping me busy.
Yeah. I sort of look at it. I use the description of spinning pie plates. So with all of that, if you're starting a vegetable garden, which pie plate did you set down, or are you just spinning one more?
No, I'm just spinning one more. I figured I didn't have enough to do.
Well, I mean, first, tell us a little bit about what made you decide that you needed to write a book like this?
You know, Alan, back after 9/11 happened, I think a lot of us went through a period of introspection. And I thought about how I raised my kids, and they were all becoming adults, and I thought, you know, there are things I would want them to know. If something happened to me and I was gone in an instant, I'd want them to know about how they should parent their children, the things I learned, the things I did well, the things I didn't do well. And I started writing down, just jotting down notes. And at about 40 pages into this jotting down notes, I looked at my husband. I said, you know, I think this is going to be a book. And it's what it ended up being. And I gave it to my kids, and they said, oh, Mom, this is great. You need to publish it. So I got it published, and we're off and running. And from there, I went out trying to sell the book and ended up getting a radio show. And life is always interesting.
Well, I know one of the topics we're going to touch on is divorce. And when did you decide this? Is this before the divorce, after the divorce, after you had stepkids?
My divorce, I was married to the father of my children for several years, but they were 4, 6, and 8 when I got a divorce from him.
Ooh, tough years.
It was, the four-year-old, you know, we sat them down and told them what was going to happen. The four-year-old went back to playing with his toys because, you know, he was oblivious. The six-year-old was a little boy, and he patted me on the shoulder after his daddy walked out and said, it's okay, Mommy, I take care of you now. Mm. I said, no, I'm the mommy, I'll take care of you. And my daughter was furious with me for a year. It was tough. It was a tough decision to make. It was the right decision, looking back on it. Even my kids all say it was the right decision to make at the time. So, you know, you got to go with your gut.
Well, and I think that poses the big question that every parent in that situation runs into, which is, how much do you tell them?
That is different depending on their age range. You know, my kids were little, and all I told them was, mommy and daddy don't get along. You see us fight. We don't get along. We're going to be better off if we have different households, but we both still love you. And that's pretty much what we told them. Mm-hmm. Now, your show is more geared towards teens, and you know, you're going to have to tell teenagers a little bit more. And don't assume that they don't know what's going on, even though you've tried to hide your fighting, or you think you've hidden the affair that so-and-so had. Teens are pretty intuitive, and they pick up on things, and they see things that you don't know that they realize. And you have to be somewhat honest to them, with them, and tell them, you know, this is why we're getting a divorce. But the biggest thing you got to tell them is it's not your fault.
I agree.
That is the biggest thing they need to know. It's not your fault. And they need to know that mom and dad still love them.
Right.
And nothing's ever going to change that.
Right. Now, when you talk about with the teens or even tweens, where you need to tell them a little bit more about what happened, I'm guessing that what you're saying is you need to tell them based on themselves. In other words, so if the one parent is not the one that, say, had the affair, don't be ragging on the other one, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think when you tell your kids, you should both sit down and have a family meeting and say, we've got something we need to talk about, and it affects you guys. You need to know what's going on in our lives. If one of them, if the divorce is caused by an affair, just say, there was an affair, we can't get past it, move on. Don't answer the nitty-gritty questions. They don't have to know all of the details of this affair. Chances are they already knew anyway that something was going on. If it's because you've just grown apart, just say, we've grown apart. You know, daddy does this, I do that, we don't get along. You know, we just don't understand each other, we've grown apart, and you guys are going to be better off if we're not together.
Right.
I can be a better mother to you, and he can be a better father to you if we're not together.
Mm-hmm. Right, which goes right to your point of as long as they know that it's not their fault and that each parent loves them.
Exactly, and that is so important. In our family, we have a terrible situation where one of my stepsons, well, my stepson is divorced from the mother of his three kids, and she has alienated him from the children. And I don't know if you know much about parental alienation, but it's where one divorced parent turns the children against the other and keeps them from seeing each other. And as a result, he hasn't seen his kids in about 4 years now.
Oh.
And they're being told that that daddy doesn't love them, and if he wants to see them, he has to go to court. You know, he's in the Navy. He doesn't have money to go to court every time he wants to see them. And it's a terrible, terrible situation. And that's a terrible, terrible thing to do to children, to tell them that one of their parents does not love them.
Well,
my ex and I were able to, even though we fought bitterly over the years about certain issues, we did it away from the kids and always backed each other up, and we always told the kids, you know, I would always tell them, your daddy loves you, and he would tell them, your mom loves you.
Right.
And we never tried to play one against the other with the kids.
Well, you mentioned the parent alienation, and the investigative side of my business world, we used to get involved in those kind of cases, and you're right, it's one of the most terrible things that a parent can do to their child, is to say that the other parent either doesn't love them, doesn't want them. When I used to return the parentally abducted kids, oftentimes that would be the first thing that we would find. And in fact, in one case, the child didn't want to leave because the other parent, the parent that had done the alienation, had discussed how evil the father was, you know, that if he did show up, or and that he was dead. So the child then took it as, with him showing up, not only is he evil, but he's some form of a ghost or a devil or something like that, because he's dead, and how can he be here now? So psychologically, you know, the parent that is doing this is causing so much damage for that child. Now, fortunately, they are so resilient that I've seen where they do get through it. And in that particular case, you know, within an hour, that child was hugging his father, and it didn't take him long to realize that maybe some of the things he'd been told weren't accurate.
That, I think that's wonderful. One of the things I've told my son is just to keep a scrapbook of, you know, holidays and say, you know, I sent you this present. This is an email I sent to your mom, or this is a letter I sent to you, and just have copies of everything, because we don't know what is sent to her actually gets to the kids.
That's a great point.
So that someday you can share that with them and say, see, I always tried through your whole life. I tried to be part of your life. I just want you to know that.
Well, that
someday they'll get the chance to do that.
Well, and that brings up a question. I mean, do you think that you parented differently because of the divorce?
I think I did.
Well, how much of that is good?
I was a single mom for many, many years. And I think I was maybe a little stricter on my kids. I looked at my two little boys and I said, oh my gosh, you know, I'm 5'2". It's not going to be long before they're bigger than me. So I'm going to have to be kind of strict with them now to make sure that, I don't have trouble with them when they're teenagers. And they also had to take a lot bigger role in household stuff. Like, they had more chores than a lot of their friends did. I couldn't do everything as a single mom. And their dad was around, and there were times I would call him and say, come get them. And he'd drive over and take them out to dinner and stuff. And that helped. But, you know, a single mom or a single dad has a lot of stress that a two-parent family doesn't have. And so sometimes the stress would get to me, and I'd snap at them when I shouldn't, and I'd have to go back and apologize.
Well, how do you control the... And I say control is probably the wrong word. How do you agree upon the way in which they're going to be parented, as far as, you know, what, you know, the same curfew in one house versus the other? I know that's really important. And were you able to make that happen?
You know, my children were so blessed that we were able to do that. My ex and I, when we talked about getting a divorce, I mean, there were some hard feelings there. And like I said, we fought bitterly over various issues throughout the years. But we sat down and we said, okay, we have to keep our kids focus on our kids. We have to make sure that they have as little upheaval in their lives as possible because of this divorce. Having said that, then we sat down and we said, okay, these are the rules. I don't say bad things about you in front of them. You don't say bad things about me in front of them. If they're grounded at my house, they're grounded at your house. And
right.
We just went through and made some rules,
mm-hmm.
and it worked for us. In fact, every Christmas, you know, in a divorce, generally you get the kids this Christmas and the other parent gets them that Christmas. And what we worked out was, they spent every Christmas morning with me,
mm-hmm.
and he came over and spent the night
wow.
on the couch. And so we were all there Christmas morning for the kids.
Now, what did your new husband think about that?
Well, you know, it was kind of weird. It was kind of strange. But, you know, I introduced him. And I said, you know, this is how we've done this for all these years, and we're not going to change it. And if you can accept that, great. And my husband calls him his husband-in-law. and we all get along really well, so it's really nice.
Well, I love the fact that, I mean, you guys figured it out. What would be some of the secrets that you can tell, which I know aren't secrets, but some of the things that you can tell the audience that are the little things that can be done to help make sure that that happens?
Okay. The main thing, and I've mentioned it, is keeping your focus on the kids. So many times we have so much anger towards our ex. You know, they've treated us badly, or they've lied to us, or they cheated on us, or they've some way hurt us, and we want to get even with them. And we have to control that tendency, and we have to think, now, okay, I can get even with them, and I might feel better for 2 minutes, but what's that going to do to my children?
Right.
And the other big thing is not talking bad about the other parent in front of the children.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, so important. You know, kids love... I have a granddaughter that I love dearly, and she's a teenager now, and several years ago she was a tween, and we were talking, and she said, you know, I go to mom's and she says bad things about dad, and I go to dad's and he says bad things about mom, and it hurts me because I love both of them so much, and I, you know, I don't want to believe bad things about them, and I don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important. It's such a strong message to send.
Okay, well, let's talk about what happens if it's already happened. So, you know, the parents couldn't control themselves. They said some things they shouldn't. And I know you mentioned that they can apologize. But after a little bit of the damage is done, you know, what can we do to help the kids deal with the emotional issues? How can we minimize the physical and emotional and actually spiritual damage inflicted upon them as a result of the divorce?
Okay. Well, first we have to realize that they are just as affected by this divorce as we are. And even in an amicable divorce, the children face serious issues. And we have to stay focused on the pain they're feeling, as well as our own pain. We have to allow them to talk to us about it and to give them the freedom to say things that, you know, maybe we don't want to hear. You know, my daughter at 8 years old was telling me, you know, that I was a terrible person and that I shouldn't have kicked their daddy out of the house. And I let her say those things. I never rebuked her for that. She had to get that out. She had to say it. I just had to show her. It was my job to show her that we were going to handle this and we were going to still be a family. And that's the most important thing. They still need to know that they're part of a family. You have to keep them in touch with the other.
Yep.
And saying, oh, you know, your dad's a slime. You don't want to be around him. You know, his new girlfriend's creepy. And you have to stop and you have to go to your child, especially with teenagers, and say, look, I've been wrong. I should not have been doing this in front of you, and I should not have been saying these things to you, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And the other thing you don't do is you don't make them spy and bring them in as a co-conspirator in your effort to get even. That's very deadly for kids. It's very damaging to them.
Right, and I think that to add to that, spying isn't just what would be considered overt spying. Covert spying, where you're just kind of pumping them for information and you think that they don't know what you're doing, I think it's probably as dangerous, if not more.
You know, I think they know more than you think they do. Like,
right.
Like, I always let my kids talk to me a lot. And when they were little, I would say, okay, now what'd you do at daddy's? And what did he do? And how did he act? And my daughter would pull me up short and say, Mom, everything was fine. We had a good time. That's it. I'd say, okay.
Well, and how old was she at that point?
Oh, 9.
That's pretty good. That's pretty insightful on her part.
Yeah, she knew what I was trying to do. It didn't work, so I quit.
Well, what about if the kids are grown? Does that mean that they have any less emotional response?
No, it you'd think it would, wouldn't you?
Right, I know.
You'd think, but you know, kids have a response no matter what age. And sometimes, like, one child may say, oh, you're finally getting a divorce. I'm so tired of listening to you two fight. Maybe things will be better. But you're going to have the other child who will say, I can't believe you're getting a divorce now after all these years. You've been together for so long. And, you know, how's this is going to impact my family? And, in fact, we had that with my stepdaughter. When we got married, my current husband and I, she wasn't at all happy about this. You know, she was daddy's little girl, and daddy moved from Texas to Georgia to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't speak to us for almost 2 years. She was furious, and she said, you're not going to know your granddaughter. You're not going to know this. You're not, you know, and you're not there for me when I need you. And it was hard. It was very, very hard. And we just had to allow her to be that angry. And we kept sending her presents, and we would, you know, on holidays and birthdays, and we would, you know, talk to her and whenever we could. And eventually, now it's a great relationship. Now we all get along great, and we're very, very close. But it was very hard.
I can imagine.
You know, these things are going to happen. Sometimes adult children will be very thrilled because it's the best thing that could happen, and other times they're just going to be devastated.
Mm-hmm. Well, we touched a little bit earlier on the discipline part, and I think this is a huge problem where you have, and years ago, I mean, if you go back to when we were younger, they used to refer to it as the Disneyland dad thing, where the mom would go, you know, it's so tough for me to do this because when dad's with them, he's only with them for a short period of time, and so he gets to play Disneyland dad and make it seem like everything's okay, there's no discipline, there's, you know, it's just everything's fun time, which is not fair either. But I mean, you know, how do you get that balance where the parents don't want to discipline the kids while they're with them because they want to be the good one? And I know that the kids are very smart, so they figure out how to manipulate this. So let's help everybody out a little bit on how you can balance that.
Well, again, it comes back to communication. If you are communicating with your ex about the kids and saying, okay, now this is what's going on in our house. You need to know that Susie did this and Johnny did that, and this is what's going on, and you need to praise her for this and punish him for that. And it's very important. My ex and I talked a lot on the phone. We talked... We actually had a lot more civil conversations after we divorced than we did before. And what we did was, he did some of that Disneyland dad stuff. Like I said, you know, before, if the kids were grounded at my house, they were grounded at his house.
As
but
it should be.
But he'd find something really, really fun to do at home. You know, that I couldn't do. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. You know, I understand if you've got them 2 days, every 2 weeks, you don't want to be the heavy all the time, and the other parent has to understand that. And if you are the custodial parent and you have them all the time, then you are going to have to be the heavy one. You are the one that is carrying the burden for all of the discipline. What's happening more and more now is joint custody.
Right.
And that makes it a lot easier if you have communication, because then both parents have equal time with the child, and both parents have an equal responsibility for discipline. And I think every parent should have a discipline plan, you know, and decide, you know, this is a boundary you don't cross. This is a boundary that's kind of gray, and we'll play with that one. And, you know, this is okay. You can do this.
Well, I noticed in your book you referred to the 3 D's.
Yeah, and that's real important. When do you, you know, divorce and punishment are two different things. You know, discipline is when you teach kids how to act and how to be responsible and how to be respectful. Punishment is what happens when they don't do those things. And a very wise physician that I know has started this 3D thing where you punish behavior that is dangerous, destructive, or disrespectful. No child should ever be allowed to do anything that's dangerous. That's why, you know, when Johnny goes to stick his hand on the eye of the stove, Mom pulls his hand away. Or when he goes to stick his finger in the light socket, Mom pulls his hand away, and he might get punished a little bit. He might get time out, or he might get put into a playpen or whatever for doing that, so that he learns not to do that. Destructive behavior, anything that is just wantonly destructive, that should be addressed immediately. Mm-hmm. That's just so many warning signs with destructive behavior. And the one that I'm so keen on is disrespectful, because there are so many kids out there today that are so disrespectful.
Yep.
While I was writing the book, this ended up in the book, but I was at a store and this mom was pushing her cute little kid in the stroller, and the kid was yelling and screaming and screaming and saying, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. And Mom said, no, no, honey, you can't have it. And the girl just stood up out of the stroller and got in her mom's face and said, I want it now! And she started screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And what did Mom do? Mom got it for her.
She rolled over, yep.
And, you know, what is that teaching your child? At first, it's teaching them they can get anything they want. And second of all, it's teaching them that you don't deserve respect.
That's right.
And if you don't deserve respect as their parent, then who in the world does deserve respect?
Oh,
so
absolutely.
You're teaching them a very bad, bad lesson there.
Yeah. Well, you just touched on a nerve for me, because I just recently discontinued, I guess would be the right term, the boys, my boys, being able to watch a particular show on television. And it's on regular television, so it's not because there is no cussing, there was no nudity, that wasn't it at all. It was sheer disrespect. The entire show was based on someone who, because he could do a particular sport really well, made him a lot of money. And the entire show is him just traveling around being as horribly disrespectful to everybody he possibly can, starting with his parents. So the boys were watching it. That they know usually, to ask me in regards to watching certain things. I looked at it. I said, that one's done. That show will not come into our home again, because I agree with you. It is so important that they understand that, because you're right. That's how they will treat everybody now. And to me, and as I watched that, I was as upset with the parents as I was with the kid, who's obviously now an adult. But I was as upset with the parents, because I thought, you created this.
Right.
You know, he's not respectful to you. And yet, you know, you're now seeing he's not respectful to the police. He's not respectful to literally anyone. And in fact, one of the comments I made, because on the show, they went to another country, and they were in another country being also very disrespectful. And I said, that's the reason why when I go into other countries, I hear stories about the ugly American.
That's right.
They're looking at this kid and thinking, gee, isn't that the way it is in America? So, yeah.
Yep. You're absolutely right, and it's so important. Kids aren't going to get along in life as adults if they don't know how to treat somebody else with respect. You've got to treat your boss with respect. You've got to treat people with the legal profession or enforcement with respect. You've got to treat your spouse with respect. You have to treat your children with respect.
Absolutely. And every person, no matter what their job is, they need to start out by receiving respect. If they do something that then leads you to believe that maybe they shouldn't get it, that's a different story. But you start out from that point, and I'm just very firm on that.
Oh, I am too. That's how I was raised.
Me too.
And that's how I raised my kids. You know, people deserve respect until they prove that they don't deserve it.
Yep.
And then you still don't treat them disrespectfully, you just stay away from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a very strong issue in my mind. It's a hot button for me right now. I see so many cases of it, and I just want to go up there and talk to these parents and say, why are you letting your child get in your face and talk to you like this?
Mm-hmm.
Why? What good is going to come from this? But, you know, you can't do that. So I talk about it a lot on the radio show.
Well, hopefully we can get them to listen, too. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes, but how can we make life better for our children after divorce? You know, even better than it was from before? Because there are some very positive things we can do. Let's share some of those, and maybe we will give some ideas out there to some of the listeners.
Well, one thing we can do is, first of all, they're going to have less dissension in their lives, most likely. It's very rare that a couple get a divorce where the kids don't know that there's tension in the house. That's almost unheard of. So right away, their life is going to be a little bit better, because they're going to feel better energy in their house. Second of all, if we have to get help with counseling for a while, it doesn't hurt us or the kids to go through a little bit of counseling, to go through and talk about what we're going through and talk about the emotions. That's something else that we can do to make life better. The other thing we can do is introduce new traditions into our family. Maybe start a new sport together. Maybe do something to get their mind off of what they've lost and focus onto something that they've gained.
Absolutely.
Some new game that we do, some new place we go, some new holiday tradition that's a lot of fun. One of the things that my kids and I did on Christmases were I gave them all ornaments every year, and that continued even after the divorce, but it was more prevalent after the divorce. It became more of a big deal, and their ornaments became something that meant something to them. So it represented something that happened to them during the previous year. And when they left home, they all took their ornaments, and they had ornaments too for their first Christmas tree. And it was a big deal in our house. It was, they would come home from college and they'd call and say, okay, when are we doing our ornaments? And they wouldn't go out with their, they wouldn't do dates that night. And it was really fun. It was really special night for us.
Well, I think that's great. And that's the type of thing that they'll pass on.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You can encourage them to find new friends, and you know, if maybe you've had to move, so they've got a whole big change in their lives, so you can encourage them to get involved in other activities, sports, scouting, anything like that, something that can make their lives better, make them happier within themselves. And the big thing is make them understand that it's not their fault. Let them see their parent, the other parent, as much as they want to see them or talk to them, you know, if that's feasible. I mean, obviously, you know, there's restrictions with school nights and homework and that kind of thing, but you know, allow that open access back and forth. It's so key. And what you'll find is that their life is better because there's not all that friction that they were living under.
Well, Pat, I couldn't agree more, and thank you. Now, if there's anybody out there, if you have additional questions, Pat, how can they get a hold of you, either through your blog, and how can they get the book?
They can buy the book off my website. Okay. It's parentsrulewithpat.com, and there's a link in there that you can get in touch with me, or you can go to info@parentsrulewithpat.com.
That sounds good. Now, with your radio show, is there an internet component that on how they can listen to your show on Thursdays?
Yes, yes. Okay. It's every Thursday from at the same time, actually.
Okay.
And it's on radiosandysprings.com.
All right. Pat, so, thank you so much. I really appreciate you,
Alan,
coming on. And I've now had a chance to read a little bit of your book. I like it, and I'll be listening to your show as well.
Great. Thanks. And hopefully I'll have you on.
I look forward to it.
Okay. That sounds great to me.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. We're back. Wow, that was an interesting noise. That was a new one for me. Anyway, our next guest is going to be Kevin Bales. He'll be calling in just a moment. In the meantime, I'm going to talk a little bit about an upcoming charity event. We have Cajun Vic's 17th Annual Crawfish Boil. I've talked a little bit about this before, but again, I want to remind everybody that this is something that it benefits refugee relief. And what refugee relief does is they go into areas with doctors and they help the local people. So in other words, if they've stepped on landmines, things like that, they go in there and they work with them. And they're working in war zones. So Cajun Vic, who puts this on, he provides the security. He is also the chef. And let me tell you, he is a great chef. So anybody, if you're in the Southern California area, if you call 714-851-6502 and get a hold of Vic, and we'll look forward to seeing you. I believe my guest is coming on right now. Kevin.
Yes, hi.
Kevin, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Hey, I appreciate you calling in, especially on short notice. I wanted to share with our listeners a little bit about what it is that you're doing, and let me tell them first. Kevin is the co-founder and president of Free the Slaves. This is the U.S. sister organization of Anti-Slavery International, which is the world's oldest human rights organization. I recently had the great opportunity to hear Kevin speak on the subject, and have also had a chance now to read two of his books. In fact, I don't even know if Kevin realizes it, because one of his books is going to be, it's just being released, but through my sources, I was able to get a copy. So,
good for you.
So, anyway, Kevin, I got to tell you, first of all, I mean, I know we spoke a little bit, so you know that you are doing something that that is truly near and dear to my heart. Now, I know that, let's start with something. Let's define slavery for the people out there, because I think that this is one of the things, especially for Americans, that I don't think they even understand that this goes on here.
You know, Al, and I appreciate, because most Americans have in their mind a picture of slavery, and it's about Africans and African Americans in cotton fields and with chains on their ankles and being sold on auction blocks, because that's the kind of slavery that America holds in its memory. But that's just one kind of slavery that's happened at just one point in human history. And of course, you know, you read the Bible, you read ancient history, you read recent history, and there's slavery all through human existence. But if you look at the core, if you look at the center of exactly what happens when one person enslaves another, it's always the same basic criteria. And those criteria are these: that one person is completely controlled by another person. So complete control by someone. They use that control to exploit them economically. They use that control to make money off of them. They use violence to maintain that control, they use violence to make people make money for them. And then questions about whether or not they get paid are important, and normally the idea is they don't get paid at all, people in slavery, but that's not really the key thing. The key thing is that somebody's completely controlling another person, violence is used to control them, and they're making money off of them.
Well, and I noticed in your first book, Disposable People, you say that slaves are disposable. Why are they disposable?
Well, in a sense, you know, I was just explaining how slavery is what it's always been.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to also be said that there is one new thing about slavery today. And that one new thing is that the price of human beings has completely collapsed. We're at an all-time historic low in the cost of bringing someone into slavery. And that's happened because over the last 50 years or so, I think we're all aware of the fact that there's been an enormous explosion in the human population. We've gone from 2 billion people to almost 7 billion people in 50 years. That doesn't make people slaves. But add in the factor that a great amount of that growth in the human population has been concentrated in the poorest parts of the world, and that very large numbers of those people have been caught up in everything from ethnic cleansing to environmental disaster to HIV epidemics, civil wars, kleptocratic governments, all kinds of reasons why they've been pushed into poverty and deprivation and real vulnerability. But just being numerous and being poor doesn't always make you a slave either. To really turn those poor, vulnerable people into slaves, you have to use violence, and that means that they're not protected by the rule of law. In other words, corruption or a lack of the rule of law or chaos in a civil war means that people can reach in there and take control of someone. Say a refugee is a classic example. You know, a refugee is in a situation where they're not being protected. There's often no law at all. And someone can use their violence to take control of them. Well, the fact is that today we have more people in that situation than ever in history. Probably 700 or 800 million people in slavery, in that situation of potential, I should say potential slaves, 700 or 800 million potential slaves, in that they could easily be taken control of. So that, you know, when you glut a market with any kind of potential supply, the price collapses, and that's exactly what happens here. Over the past 2,000 or 3,000 years, the average price of an average slave has been about $40,000 to $50,000 in today's money.
Right.
But today the average price is about $90.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, I know that with some of the statistics that both you know and I know, that, you know, that there's 27 million people worldwide already enslaved, and what I didn't know that you just said is that if there's 700 to 800 million potential, I see exactly what you're talking about. From the standpoint of supply and demand, it's just so easy for them to just go get another one.
That's it. That's about it. You know, in the in those countries, it's especially about where the rule of law isn't working right, and that can be the cause of corruption. It can also, but it can also be because of conflict, and, you know, and in a place like Eritrea, Ethiopia, the Congo, Liberia, until very recently Sierra Leone, the former Yugoslavia, as soon as the civil war broke out with Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, and so forth, the amount of slavery in that country shot through the roof. So take away those protections that keep all of us safe. And one of the things that we're being protected from is enslavement as well.
Well, let's. I want to get right to the main point, and one of the things that, that is in one of your books, which is what can we do to defeat it? And again, one of the books, you know, in one of your books, it says that we can end slavery in the next 25 to 30 years. How can we do that? And how can the people listening, what can they do to help?
Well, the most important thing right now is to learn about the problem. You know, everyone who's listening right now is actually doing the most important first step for them to become an abolitionist, because you can't solve a problem you don't understand, and you sure can't solve a problem you've never even heard of, even one that touches so many people. So step one is always going to be about raising our awareness and coming to understand, you know, what's in front of us and what's appropriate for us to do as well. And then it's about making some decisions and making a commitment. Now, you know, I don't mean necessarily a financial commitment. I mean the idea that I hope people will say, you know, I don't want to live in a world with slavery. In fact, I'm going to be committed to living in a world without slavery. I don't want my kids to grow up in a world with slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, who wants a world with slavery? I don't think there's only a handful of people on the planet that would ever even agree with that idea.
And that would
so
be the slave owners.
So it's about saying, I do want to get rid of this. Sorry? Mm-hmm.
I said, and that would be the slave owners themselves. That's the only people
exactly.
that want it, those that profit from it.
Exactly. And there aren't even a lot of those slaveholders in the world, interestingly. You know, it's probably 4 or 5, maybe 6 million people at most who are involved in the criminal activity of enslaving people. And you know, the thing with what you can do with criminals is you can either bust them and lock them up so that they're out of circulation, or make it so hard for them to make profit off a particular kind of crime like slavery that they just stop doing it and do something else, and which might be legal or might not. But they can be pushed away from this. I think the important thing to understand is that there's a lot of people in slavery in the world, but the amount of money that they generate into the global economy is actually very small in terms of its relative value. The 27 million slaves probably put about $40 to $50 billion into the global economy, but that's a drop in the ocean in the trillions and trillions of dollars that make up the global economy. There's not really any vested, big scale vested interest in preserving slavery today as there was, say, in the cotton industry of the past or the sugar industry of the past. It's actually, slavery's been pushed right up to the margins of global society, both socially and in terms of its criminality and in terms of its economics. And it's really standing right on the edge of its own extinction. If we learn to see it, and if we learn to see it, we can kind of sneak up behind it and boot it over the edge of that precipice of extinction and get rid of it.
Well, and can you share a little bit, and I'm aware of some of this stuff, but if you can share with the audience a little bit of the ways in which slaves are being used, because I think there is this, there's two fallacies that I'd like you to clear up, at least as Americans see it. And one is that it's only being used in prostitution. And the second is that it doesn't happen here in America, that it's only happening in other countries or in non-developed countries. Can you touch on those two points? Because I know those are huge.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I have to tell you, it absolutely is happening right here in the United States. And you know, I'm actually sitting in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting just outside of a conference room where I've been with 20 other anti-human trafficking, anti-slavery organizations as we've been plotting how we're going to get the government to do a better job at addressing this and how we're going to help the public to understand it. So a lot of those groups are, in fact, immediately and directly involved in helping people who have been enslaved in the United States and to helping them to back into a normal life. But now in terms of what slaves are doing in the United States, about the best estimates that we have suggest that just under half, so less than half, not the majority, of the people in slavery in the United States are actually enslaved in prostitution. But it's the largest single category. Something like 47% of the people in slavery in the United States are enslaved into prostitution. But the next highest category, something like 25%, are people, normally women, enslaved into domestic service. So the book, for example, that we're just publishing this week, the one that you got a copy of called The Slave Next Door, we open that book with the story of a particularly horrific case of a teenager enslaved as a domestic servant by a housewife in Texas, and how the next door neighbor was the person who saved that girl's life. It kind of directly illustrates that idea of the slave next door. And I think it's important to understand that even if someone's enslaved as a domestic servant, that doesn't mean they're not going to be sexually assaulted. Almost all women who are in slavery, in no matter what they're doing, restaurant work, agricultural work, domestic service, they're going to end up being sexually assaulted as well, because men have total control over them. That's what slavery is about, and they're going to use that control to assault them. After domestic service, we have maybe 15 or 18% of the people in slavery in the United States are in agriculture. Agricultural work across Florida and Texas and into California and sometimes up the East Coast as well. And then, you know, I have to tell you, after that, there are the most amazing collections of different ways in which people are enslaved in the United States it's almost unbelievable. I'll give you a couple of examples. I've met acrobats from China enslaved in Las Vegas to do acrobatics. I have a good friend, in fact, a young man who was enslaved as an 11-year-old, trafficked into the country from Africa as part of a boys' choir, who was taken around churches as part of a charity scam to sing their little hearts out, and then the people in the churches would give money to build schools in their villages, which never, ever reached their villages. They went into the pockets of the traffickers. I met Peruvians enslaved in a cannoli factory making cannoli pastries in Long Island. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. Criminals are clever, and they'll figure out great ways to use slaves if we're not watching.
Now, do you have teams that you're using that are helping to rescue them? I mean, I know when you spoke, I know that you have ways that you get them retrained afterwards, of which I totally respect. But as far as the teams that are actually getting them out, when they're located in those situations, who's getting them out?
I have to say, in the United States, we don't have teams. We have teams in Haiti, India, Pakistan, Nepal, West Africa, and so forth. In the United States, because there are a number of organizations that have been doing that longer and I think better than us needing to jump in there, we rely either on police or local organizations that are service providers. So it could be anyone from Polaris Project to local action groups or local task forces on human trafficking and like that. So we don't, but we certainly have friends that do.
Well, Kevin, let me tell you, you do now. Okay, I'll make the announcement right now over this. You have one. If you call on us, it's one of the things that we do here and abroad. When you have them, you let us know. We will be the ones to go in there and get them out for you.
Great. Thank you so much. Because, you know, there's oftentimes when people, good Samaritans, discover a situation right in their neighborhood, and they'll often call the police, and the police will say, "Oh, you know, I think that's an immigration problem," or, "You know, I think that may be a domestic ruckus going on there." And then we get a call, And when we get the descriptions, it sure sounds like a trafficking case. Mm-hmm. And then we have to then go on, and I'm very appreciative that your expertise could be brought to bear on this.
Well, we will certainly do whatever we can. Now, we're about to run out of time, but can you do a couple of things? One is, can you tell people, how can they get the new book? The new book is The Slave Next Door, Human Trafficking and Slavery in America Today. How can they get this?
You can go straight on to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any online booksellers got it. And most of the big chain bookshops have got it right now as well. It should be stacked up somewhere near the front of the store about now. The last time I looked, they were just hitting the shops around here in Washington. So it's out there and pretty easy to get.
Okay, and for the people that want to know more, they want to know what they can do, how can they get a hold of you as part of the Free the Slaves organization?
Well, the easiest way, and we do have on our website a booklet that you can download that has everything a local community member can do to deal with the possibility of slavery and what they can do in their local community. It's a great booklet for churches or schools or book clubs or like that. And it's called The Community Member's Guide. And that's available on our website, which is freetheslaves.net. So that's the Free the Slaves, all one word, .net.
Kevin, thank you for what you do. Thank you for taking a little bit of your time to come on the show. And can I get you to commit to come on again in the near future?
Absolutely.
When we have a little more time.
I really appreciate the chance.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time. I know you're breaking away from a meeting to do it. But again, everybody, that is freetheslaves.net. There is probably not many things more important than you can do, but check this out and see what you can do in your own area. Kevin, again, thank you.
My pleasure. Happy. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.